So welcome everyone to this interview where I'm really happy to be talking with Dr. Valerie Mason-John. Firstly, Valerie, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So I'm looking forward to getting into this interview. I think Valerie has a very powerful voice in this dialogue that we're going to be coming into. I haven't had as much time as I would have liked to have read some of her work, but I've read some and it's powerful and I recommend it. And I'm looking forward to getting into this dialogue. Just to give people Valerie's background, Dr. Valerie Mason-John is one of the leading African descent voices in the field of mindfulness for addiction. She co-founded the accredited program, Mindfulness-Based Addiction Recovery, and 8-Step Recovery Meetings, which is also an award-winning book. She works as a senior compassionate inquiry facilitator for addiction and trauma and works as a practitioner. Author and co-editor of 9 books, her most recent published this year, I'm Still Your Negro, A Homage to James Baldwin, which I've just been having a bit of a look at this morning, is a social justice poetics that is responding to all the killings and traumas of black and brown bodies. President of the Buddhist Recovery Network, she is also a public speaker and is based between North America and Europe. So, Valerie, I wanted to start just by putting some sort of frame and context around some of what we're going to come into today, which is sort of a two-part question, really, around what is trauma in the way that you understand it, and then also what is ancestral trauma? And, you know, for I think one of the things that's been part of my own learning in recent weeks, which I would caveat that at the beginning of a journey, but trying to get my head better around some of these issues, is things like slavery, things that happened in the past, which it's very easy, I think particularly easy for white people to go, well, that happened in the past. I didn't have anything to do with that. That's not my responsibility. The past has an enormous impact and there's a whole body of trauma which is held. I'd love you to speak a bit to that. But as I say, I think perhaps let's just start with what is trauma and then let's come into what is ancestral trauma.
Well, that's a very big topic. What is trauma? What is ancestral trauma? So let's begin with trauma. I'm going to speak of trauma from a mindfulness approach, even a Buddhist approach. Because what we would say is that trauma is the disconnection from the body. You know, whenever something painful happens, we flee the body. We move away from the body and nobody's home. All feelings have been switched off. All lights have been switched off. You know, all sense doors have been closed down. And what actually happens is that with trauma, it's the disconnection from our direct experience, which on a particular level, it's natural for us to move away from painful experience. And the trauma happens after we move away from this painful experience, because what happens is that we don't come back to the direct experience. We don't come back to the body. And we lose connection to the body. We lose connection to all feeling. And of course, as humans, we need connection. And so what do we begin to connect with? Now, one of my teachers, Dr. Gabor Maté, will often say is, who did you speak to when something painful happened? Who did you speak to? And this is the trauma because there was nobody to speak to. And I take that one step further because it isn't that there was nobody we didn't speak to, because we did actually end up speaking to somebody. We ended up speaking to ourselves. We ended up speaking to our dolls or our action man or our pets. And we created this story. And then what happens is we create this fixed self. Yeah, and I want to say that again. What happens is we disconnect from our direct experience. We disconnect because things are always changing. And we connect to a story which becomes fixed. And we're still identifying with this story 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years later. And the story hasn't changed. And that's the trauma. And what happens is that something will activate us and the past comes into the present and we're identifying with this story, the story that nobody loves me, the story that I don't belong, the story of I've been humiliated, the story I've been abandoned. Okay, so this is the trauma when we get stuck in this fixed story.
And that story effectively becomes identity, right?
Exactly.
We ourselves to be, yeah.
Exactly. This, as you say, it becomes our identity and the identity becomes fixed. So part of the healing is to see through the illusion of the story, to see through the fabrication and the concoction of the story. And of course, we need to fabricate and concoct this story so that we could survive. This is, you know, when we talk about magical thinking, that's all what it's about. It's like, you know, for a child, the parents split up, daddy leaves or mommy leaves, and the child tells themselves, daddy left, mommy left because of me. It was my fault.
And that's, I guess that's something about the kind of, for want of a less technical term, the egocentric nature of being a child, right? That the world revolves around us. So if one of our parents leaves, it must be our fault.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Blame ourselves. And another really important thing that I want to say, it's something that really changed my mind, is Dr. Gabor talks about attachment and authenticity. And often, the trauma is that we will go for the attachment rather than the authenticity. So what happens is that actually we attach to our stories. This is what I see. We attach to our stories, make it about ourselves, which stops us from actually talking to the people we need to talk to. Why did daddy leave? Why did mommy leave? We don't do that because we don't want to hurt them. We want the attachment, because if we go with the authenticity, we're often told, be quiet, you'll get over it. Don't talk about it. I mean, it's amazing. There are clients I've worked with where they've had a parent die and they were sent to school during the funeral. Wow. They didn't even get to go to the funeral. Wow. So what message are you giving this young person? Don't talk to us about it. Yeah. And so if you want that attachment, you don't talk about it. And then you can't be authentic and you attach to these stories that become this fixed self, this identity. And we know things change. I mean, what happened? What happened 50 years ago is very different to what is going on in our lives now. Okay, so that for me is trauma.
And of course, that story we have about what happened is often the story created from our perspective, taking, for example, childhood trauma, from the perspective of us, let's say, of 4 years old, which may be a fully accurate reflection of what happened, or it may be our individual experience of what happened. I'm thinking, like, for an example, might be that a parent was unnurturing and unholding around our feelings and emotions. We learned that I'm not loved, but actually from the parents' perspective, they were going through a difficult personal time and it wasn't about them not loving us. It was about them not being able to love, just to demonstrate love. So it's often these stories are not always based upon the entire reflective truth of that instance. They're what we take from that instance.
Exactly. And we often believe the story that harms us more. And that's the work of actually really what did happen, what could be the possible reasons why something happened. But we want to hold on to the story because it means we have to change. And we don't want to change. We don't like change. I mean, we've seen that during COVID-19. we don't want change. But I want to kind of begin to move towards this ancestral trauma. But before we move into this ancestral trauma, let's look at implicit trauma and explicit trauma, because there is trauma, of course, which is held in the body. Okay, it's definitely held in the body. And I'll give you an example from my own experience. I grew up in orphanages, and I never knew anything about my background at all. And one thing that I would have told you when I was in my early 20s or late teens is that, oh, my birthday, it's a difficult time, and it's a difficult time, and I'll get through it in January, the beginning of January. And I would always, New Year's resolutions, January the 5th, January the 6th, that's when I would make a New Year's resolution. Also, when I started having relationships, they would end after 6 weeks. Okay. I got to read my records in my mid-20s. And when I read my records, I was separated from my biological mother at 6 weeks.
Wow.
And I was separated on January the 5th, January the 6th, it said in my records.
Wow.
So that's the implicit memory. Somewhere I had this knowing. I don't know. It was in the body.
Yeah.
And what a relief to be able to see that. It completely transformed my life. Yeah.
It's almost like, and forgive me if I this isn't quite right, but what I'm sort of hearing you say is you took an implicit trauma and you made it explicit, that somehow you could make sense of something that was a trauma that was hard to conceptualize and make sense of. And somehow it sounds like that somewhat validated your experience, but it perhaps also helped you process and digest some of that experience.
Exactly. And that's what we need to do to be able to heal from trauma. It is possible to heal from trauma. It is. But we have to come home to the body. And that's a very painful place to be. You know, who wants to come home to the body? I mean, I just to let people know, I might say something which is a bit activating for people. I was somebody who was sexually abused, physically abused. What did I do to cope with it? I split from the body. Mm. Yeah, there was nobody home. So I didn't have to feel anything. The amount of physical pain which was subjected to my body, you know, I would put it in the realm of both torture and sadomasochism. Mm. Yeah. Wow. As a child.
One of the things that struck me reading some of your book, Detox Your Heart, particularly where I think you speak very honestly and very bravely about some of your struggles with addiction in the past. And one of the things that touched me there was just, and you know, Dr. Gabor Maté, as you mentioned, I think speaks well to this, there was something about the kind of human story of it that you wrote about, is that it becomes effectively, addiction becomes a way of self-medicating those emotions. It becomes a way of that. A lot of what addiction is not people that want to be using alcohol or drugs or whatever. Actually, it's a way of trying to medicate the intensity of that pain that's held in the body.
Yeah, it's an adaptation. And it's as a child, we don't have the access to the alcohol or the drugs when we're really young. Yeah, and so we find different ways to adapt, to cope. But as we get older, it's like, oh, you know, the alcohol that we can switch off, or the drugs that we can switch off. Yeah, and it is definitely, I see it as self-medication, that we're really trying to medicate the pain, to split from the pain, which I always say is a bit of an oxymoron, because in mindfulness, when we're working with addiction, we're talking about coming home to the body. Yeah. But yet, if you're somebody who's got these addictive behaviors, you want to split from the body. It's all about having altered experiences, and you're saying come home to the body. But let's get back to this implicit trauma and ancestral trauma. So I want to go to the fetus. And also, let's bring in the male into this as well, into male sperm. Now, we know there is evidence that if men are completely dysregulated, are in a difficult situation, or have had a trauma, perhaps somebody has died, or perhaps they've been arrested, all those kind of things, and they have sexual intercourse, that sperm, the DNA of that sperm is going to be impacted, okay? It's going to change the DNA of that sperm. We know that if a woman is carrying a fetus, if she's in a violent relationship, or perhaps one of her parents have died, or, you know, perhaps poverty, can't feed her children, all sorts of reasons, the fetus is going to be impacted. There's going to be an overload of cortisone, and the baby is going to come out dysregulated, okay? So already, you know, even before this child has entered the world, this baby is dysregulated and can come out hungry. And so again, it's really important, actually, I would say, for some people who don't really understand what's going on for them, why are they activated in certain ways? It's to find out your parents' history of when you were conceived. Find out, because this might tell you something. You know, imagine a couple, she's, you know, the woman is pregnant 3-4 months and a parent dies. Imagine what impact that's going to have on the parent and on the fetus. It may mean that the parents might not even be able to be there for the child when the child is born. So this is really important to find out about the history of our conception. Okay.
And sometimes that can be quite challenging. For example, you know, knowing a little bit about some of your history, that although your birth mother was around, and at one point you did go back and live with her for a period of time, but for some people, I'm thinking of a good friend of mine who was adopted and actually knows nothing about his birth parents, I guess would be the term, that sometimes that's a piece of someone's history. In fact, I speak from my own experience. There's a whole story actually I talk about in my session in the conference about my father leaving soon after I was born and not having that piece. And it took, I was in my early 30s before I finally tracked him down and met him. And that, although that experience wasn't a very easy experience, it was a very important experience of having some processing and closure on that history. So I think it's a very important point you make, and it can be quite challenging sometimes for people even to get that insight.
And for somebody who's adopted, and I will quote Dr. Gabor Maté again when he talks about the stamp of abandonment. So for somebody who was adopted, one of their early traumas, I wouldn't necessarily say it was the first trauma, because actually in the fetus, if the mother knows that she's not going to be able to keep this child, already the child is going to come out into the world dysregulated. So there could have been traumas even before this stamp of abandonment, but we know that one of the extreme traumas would have been when that child was given up for adoption, and that will be held in the body.
Yes.
And I've actually worked with people who have been adopted and have had real issues of separation. And this is, again, even for myself, separation issues, I really had to go into inquiry with this, because why did I get so activated when my partner would leave the house without not telling me? And I would get so activated. It was like, you need to tell me when you're leaving the house. And after doing some inner work, I thought, bingo. It's because at one point I was given up and my biological mother never came back. Yeah. So I don't know. I didn't know whether this person was going to come back. And often a lot of people who have been adopted have this same separation anxiety. Again, it's held in the body.
And it actually, in many ways, what it speaks to is the wisdom of the body, that the body is trying to protect itself from that pain being repeated.
Yes, yes, yes. So let's talk about this ancestral trauma. Firstly, I want to quote from Rezma Menaken. Yeah. And if you haven't read his book, Grandmother's Hands, please do. And I'm a bit dyslexic, so I'm not sure that I pronounced Rezma Menaken's name correctly. So apologies if I haven't. But he talks about white supremacy is in our blood, literally, in our nervous systems. However light or dark our skins, we Americans must all contend with these elemental forces. Call it white body supremacy. And I would say that definitely that white supremacy lives in the blood of white British people. Yeah. Mm. White European people. So ancestral trauma. This brings me to the recent uprisings that have been happening. Yeah. I need to pause. In fact, let's track back to 2016, because I would say that my most recent book, I'm Still Your Negro, Homage to James Baldwin, was in response to what was happening in 2016, to Eric Garner's death, to Trayvon Martin's death. And it just seemed every day I was waking up to another black body being killed by the police or by white supremacy. And I just, it really had a visceral impact on my body. Let's track forward. I went to see Harriet, and I went to see Harriet with my white friend. And I, as soon as Harriet came on, 5 minutes in, my whole body went into a crisis. I shivered and my teeth chattered throughout that whole film. Yeah. It was as if somewhere in my DNA, you know, we talk about epigenetic trauma, cells were switched on and there was a memory. There was a memory in this body. And I was completely distressed. Let's come a bit forward, rewind.
And I can just say, I think one of the things that is very important about what I think you're saying here is there's not just a socially constructed narrative and trauma that's here. There's actually, and I agree, I think Rezma writes very beautifully about it, that there's something which is actually held in the body, in the DNA, in the blood, which is beyond just, although they're still very important, those socially constructed narratives.
I mean, in my book, I channeled Thomas Peters, who was one of the first black freedom fighters in the 1700s, okay? And I just channeled where does that come from? So coming fast forward, George Floyd. I remember my partner who said, I've watched it, and my partner is white. And she had watched the George Floyd video and said, I've just watched a George Floyd video, I'm in tears. And I just thought, well, maybe I need to watch this, because I thought, oh, I'm not going to watch this. And on one level, I'm glad that I watched it. Okay. And I watched that. And I went into a dark night. I went into a dark night period. And I watched it. And it was as if now, as I talk about it, I can see our black bodies being buried up to our neck, and those white horse riders who wanted to play polo, they would bury us up to our neck and then with their horses try and kick our heads off. And as I talk about it, I can see our black and brown bodies being tied to the back of a car and the white people just driving. In fact, I don't know whether it's true, but it's said that the word picnic came from pick a nigger. Yeah. Wow. And so white people would go out and grab a black person, tie them back to the back of the car and just drive off. Pick a nigger. Whether picnic comes from that, there was this play of pick a nigger. And so this ancestral trauma, yeah, when I, it's, so there is myself being completely activated. It was lynching all over again. And it's as if my body had a memory of lynching. And then not just coupled with this ancestral trauma for many of us, it's also trauma in the here and now, because many of us in black and brown bodies have been traumatized by the police. We have been brutalized by the police, but we got to live. Yeah. I myself, as a teenager, as 15, you know, 14, 15 on an anti-Nazi march, one of the few black people on that march, and the police singled me out for carrying a banner. And I was a bit stroppy there. I was stroppy. It's like, why are you picking on me? The only black person on the march, why are you picking on me? All these white people. I got grabbed, thrown into a police van, taken into police station, and a woman ramming her hand up my crotch to see if there was dangerous weapons there. So we know it. Many of those black people on the streets know that police brutality, but we just didn't have the cameras. Okay, we know it. So it's not just this ancestral trauma that's activated us and got us on the streets. It's the knowing. We have that memory.
There was something also that struck me in the, I think it was in the, I read it in the foreword to I'm Still Your Negro, and it resonated with something I'd read some other places, that the effectively mass incarceration of particularly black men in the United States is its own modern form of slavery.
I have to watch 13. It's a really important documentary. 13, and it just widening the lens of that black men are the most incarcerated all over the world. Even in Canada, where I live, where we are in the minority, and okay, we know that there is the mass incarceration of Indigenous people, but yet percentage-wise, black men are more heavily incarcerated than Indigenous people. If we look at percentage-wise of how many, you know, Indigenous people there are, how many black people there are, yeah, it's a modern form of slavery. So again, when we're talking about trauma, there is the trauma of so many black and brown bodies not growing up with their fathers, okay? And again, this goes back to slavery, because we were separated from our fathers, yeah? And also we know in the United States of America, there's also encouragement not to grow up with your fathers. We'll give you more money if you're a single parent, okay? So there's some memory of this is a normality of not growing up with your father. And this comes from slavery. And I also, again, I want to talk about 12 Years a Slave. Yeah. When I watched that film of 12 Years a Slave again, to me, I just thought, oh my God, this is the legacy of ancestral trauma. This is the legacy. There are two things I want to talk about that film, of just, again, when we come back to George Floyd and we watch this black man saying, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And the police do nothing. It brings me back to when we look at, it's not even 12 Years a Slave, it's in Kunta, in Roots, where they're whipping the black guy, is being held up. What's your name? Kunta Kinte. What's your name? Kunta Kinte. What's your name? Kunta Kinte. And every time he's being whipped, Kunta Kinte, and finally he gives an English name and they let him go. They don't even let George Floyd go. They don't even let him go. Yeah. And then again, coming back to 12 Years a Slave, this, the legacy of the beating. Where did we learn to beat our children? And it's not just black people who beat their children. And let's look at, where did white people learn to beat their children? Slavery, whipping, slavery, this which has been passed down. Get the belt out, which has been passed down. There is so much of this ancestral trauma that has been passed down to us. So what this means is that when I come into the world, when black and brown bodies come into the world, we're already dysregulated, okay? So if I come into the world as black as I am, some parents will be freaked out because it's like, oh my God, this black child is going to have a harder life than the lighter skinned child, okay? I have the trauma of being so dark, because the blacker you are in certain communities, the uglier you are. The lighter you are, the prettier you are. And we know, even in biracial relationships, I can remember as a young person, it was like, have a biracial relationship because you would produce a pretty child. Okay.
Wow. One of the things I was struck by in the introduction to I'm Still Your Negro is you talked about as a child that you tried to whiten your skin.
Yeah. And again, this implicit memory. I must have been about 7 or 8, and I heard on the radio about a child trying to bleach their skin. And I remember being completely activated. I just remember being so disturbed by this story. And then in my mid-20s, I read my records, and bingo, that's what I had done. Wow. Yeah. So I had no memory, explicit memory of it. So I want to come back to, again, there's so much to talk about, this trauma. Because as I said, I have a white partner. And after George, I was so glad. I actually said to my partner, I'm really glad that you're away working at the moment. Because I lost faith in humanity. Complete faith in humanity. But fortunately, I didn't get stuck in that trauma because I had people to speak to. Okay? Because I really lost faith in humanity. It was like, how could I have slept beside my white partner? And also, it wasn't just white people. I was completely disturbed when I was watching that video. And in front of me, it was an Asian policeman. I remember thinking, but they're Asian. What's going on? They're Asian. And I lost faith for a moment. I disconnected. I had lost faith in humanity, which is why I went into this dark night period. But because I had people to talk to. I didn't have to talk to myself. Because I could process it, because there were things that I could do, I didn't get stuck in the trauma. Many people on the streets got stuck in the trauma.
And that's why having support and community and sharing someone's where someone is so important, right?
Exactly. It's so important. And what you know, just coming to the uprisings, as you say, sharing is so important. What we see is trauma bonding. On the street was trauma bonding.
Yeah, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful. That's what was happening. People completely disconnected from themselves, connected to the anger and the rage of 500 years, and also the rage, you know, white people having the rage, because we live in a time when many white people have black and brown children, okay? This is what was different. And this is for me, one of the great shifts was the ally work of black, brown and white bodies being on the streets. And what we see is in that anger and rage, because I talk about the codependency of racism, okay? And part of that codependency is that we've just gone along with the Confederate flag. Yeah, we've gone along. We haven't said much. We've gone along with some of these statues that have glorified racism. But what we saw was the destruction of the mythos. The destruction of the mythos. Seeing some of these statues tumbling. No more are we going to go for the attachment of being the good black person. And I was going to say the good nigger. Okay, and I will say that. It's like born a nigger, always a nigger. It's like no matter what we do, we get the education. We get the education. We don't go into the life of crime. And yet we're still always a nigger on the streets. When we're on the streets, people see us as black. Okay?
I think you're also something else that I am mindful of time, but I think it's a really, really, if you've got the time, I've got the time, but I think it's a really important piece I wanted to come to as well, which is, again, one of the things that I think is very powerful about what you're saying here, and also about what you're speaking to in I Am Still Your Negro, is there is so much also to be proud of, that it, as much as ancestral trauma is enormous in its impact, it doesn't mean that one has to discard their heritage and so much that there is to be proud of. And I'd love you to speak to that as well.
Yeah, thank you for raising that, because I'm actually editing a book on African wisdom. I'm just in the process of that. And for me, I do talk about this ancestral wisdom. Okay. Yeah. Let's call in our ancestors. When I think of England, you know, I live between Europe and North America, and I think of Mary Seacole. That the wisdom she had. I when I think of here in Canada, I think of Thomas Peters. When I think of the US, I think of Ida Bell Barnett. Ida D. Bells, Ida B. Bells. If I got Ida Bell Wells, who wrote about the lynchings, but who had this wisdom. And then the wisdom we had before we were enslaved. Okay. Slavery 500, 600 years ago, but we existed on the planet thousands and thousands of years ago. We talk about the first the first human being who was found in Africa. Okay, can't remember her name at the moment. What's her name? The first, it will come to me. She was found in Africa. So we have been around a long time. And those thousands and thousands of years outweigh this 500, 600 years of slavery. And we can recover from this. This is how we can recover. But part of that recovery has to be through white allyship. I went to Spring Washam. Spring Washam is doing, she calls it the Church of Harriet Tubman. And one of the things she did last week was to remind white people of the white abolitionists, okay? And in a way, we got some of our freedom, not all of our freedom, but we got some of our freedom because of white abolitionists. And that was allyship. So again, white people can call on their ancestral wisdom for us to work together to change this systemic racism, to change this systemic trauma. Because I, as a black person, am not completely free. I belong to a Buddhist community, and I won't out my Buddhist community, but I belong to a Buddhist community. And one of my friends, one of my dear friends who's Asian American, on one of our websites had this picture of her being on a demonstration, a Black Lives Matter demonstration. If you knew the furor that created by having this on a website because it was political.
Wow.
Okay. Every day for those of us in black and brown bodies is a political. Every day I walk on the streets, it's political. You cannot separate the personal from the political. You cannot separate trauma from black and brown bodies. It's in our DNA. And coming back to Resmé Menakem, who says white supremacy is in our blood, whether you're black, brown, or white, it's in our blood. But you know what? Black wisdom is in our blood. White wisdom is in our blood. Okay? It's in our DNA. And those are the cells that we need to begin switching back on.
I think that's beautiful, and I think very powerful. And I'm mindful of time. There are so many pieces here, Valerie, that we could have gone into. I'm already planning of hopefully having the opportunity of a future interview. There's so much more I'd like to get into, but I am mindful of time, and I think that's a really good endpoint. For people that want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way to do that, and maybe say a bit about what they can find?
My website would be the easiest place to find me, which is www.valeriemason-john.com. But if you Google me, I will come up. And you will get to see what I have to offer. Yeah, that's what I would say. You can find me on, I'm not a big Twitter person. Actually, I need a secretary. I'm just kind of in the process of actually getting myself a secretary. I am on Twitter, V Mason John, or 8 Figure 8 8-Step Recovery. I'm also on Instagram on 8-Step Recovery. But the best place to find me is on my website, or Facebook, actually. Facebook is somewhere where you can find me. And the best way to find me would be under Valerie Mason John, or Vimala Sara, my Buddhist name, Vimala Sara Mason John.
Yeah, there's so much of your work we haven't got into today, particularly your work around addictions. I would love to have had more time for. But to recommend, we've mentioned a bit, I Am Still Your Negro. I think that's there's some beautiful poems in here that I would recommend as well. I think it's a great way of giving some voice and giving some, bringing alive some of these themes. And also just, I've got it here, Detox Your Heart, which I think is, I've really been enjoying as well. So Valerie, thank you.
Can we end with one of my poems?
Yeah, I was worried you might not have enough time, but if you would, I'd love you to read one of the poems, yes.
Okay, I will choose the poem of my father's prayer for all of those who have experienced a trauma of not knowing their father. So I'll dedicate the poem to you, Alex, yeah, okay? You. My father's prayer. My father, who art in the universe, what on earth is your name? Will you ever come? Thy will be home, dead or alive. Give me day or night your daily name, and I will forgive your sons, forgiving all those who have colluded with your sins. And lead me not into more unhappiness, but deliver me from this pain. For thou have the power and the knowledge forever and ever of all men.
That's beautiful.
Okay.
And that's a great place to finish. I wish we had more time. Dr. Valerie Mason-John, thank you so much for today. I think it's been I love the way that you kind of break things down into very simple ways, but you also bring a lot of kind of passion and heart to it. It was really great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.